helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel. I am frequently amazed by how many people place so much faith in government actors. It seems that people forget that government is, well, it's full of people, and those people are not perfect. So many people look to government to protect them, only to find those they entrusted to be the cause of even more problems. The more we entrust to government, the more it lets us down, even with all of those failures. More and more people entrust government with more and more of their lives. Will the American people ever learn those 9 most terrifying words in the English language that Ronald Reagan warned us about?
I think you all know that I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help."
So let's look at some of the more recent examples of government help and the trouble that it's caused and see if we can't learn this lesson. I'm not saying there's no room for government, and there's nothing that government can't do. But why do we keep entrusting failures and expect it suddenly to be different? Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome, is exactly what Albert Einstein said was the definition of insanity. Well, hello there, everyday Americans. Paul Engel here with the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free, and I am so glad you could join me today. You know, some of the latest news, and you know, I don't jump all over the news. I'd like to let things sit and percolate a little bit. This is not a news program. This is an opinion program. It's an educational program. So when the news broke over the weekend that not one but 2 banks were, went under. Was it Silicon Bank and Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank? I'm sitting there going deja vu all over again. I'm old enough to remember the housing crisis. I'm old enough to remember how that got set up, and I'm old enough to remember what happened and how it started off small and then snowballed. So we have a bank, Silicon Valley Bank, and it was mismanaged. There's no other way to put it, right? They did several things that were fiscally unsound. Now, listen, I'm not an investment banker. I'm not in that finance world, but I'm a relatively intelligent person. So what have I found? Well, so far what I've learned is that the bank, how do I put this? They borrowed money on long term and lent money on short term. So what I understand is part of their problem is they would borrow money, they would lend money out that could easily be paid off and then would have to find somebody else to loan it to. But they funded themselves with long-term debt. They were vested very heavily in treasury bonds. And those treasury bonds are very susceptible to interest rate changes. Now, this worked really great when interest rates were low, right? Because they could borrow, get money from these bonds. They could invest in these bonds. And as long as interest rates were low, the bond rates were low, life was good. But as interest rates have been going up, well, now those bonds with very low interest rates, they aren't worth as much. You can't trade them for as much as you used to because the interest rate is low. If you could, which would you rather buy? Would you rather buy a bond with an interest rate of 0.5% or 3%. Well, if you're going to get 3% on your back on your money, you want that one. You don't want the 0.5%. So that truly exposed the bank. Now, there's a lot that goes in behind this. These are models that have huge numbers of inputs. For example, interest rates. Well, interest rates are being driven up in large part because inflation has been climbing. Inflation has been climbing because we've spent decades spending money we don't have. And over the last 3 years, we went hog wild crazy spending money we don't have, borrowing a lot of money. And as soon as the economy started coming out of the enforced depression, the enforced oppression of these governments. Well, suddenly you've got all this money and it's moving because people are working and spending, and there's not enough productivity to eat to soak it up, to drive up the interest rates. And SVP either was unwilling to recognize or unable to recognize or just unwilling to do anything about this situation to put them into. And it made people nervous. Depositors of the bank were nervous. So what did they do? Well, they did the logical thing. They went to the bank and tried to get their money out. And that further caused problems for SVB because now they don't have enough cash on hand to cover their loans, to cover their expenses. And the federal government comes in and takes them over. Now, if this sounds at all familiar, well, it should. Because in the early 2000s, at the behest of the government, at the direction of government regulators, of politicians, Bernie Frank being one of the more infamous ones, banks were encouraged to make loans, housing loans, mortgages for less and less qualified people. The logic being is, everybody should have a house. Everybody should own a home. So they started lending, and of course the government said, no, you have to lend even more unqualified. Sometimes even said you have to because if not, you're racist. So these banks made more and more loans to less and less qualified people, and they loved it, right? Because they would make the loan, and they'd get all the fees for making the loan, and then they would sell that loan to somebody else, so it didn't harm them directly. But the banks that bought up those mortgages, they would then repackage them and have them send them off as investment tools. They had some exposure because they had these notes, these mortgages on their books. And then as soon as inflation started kicking up and interest rates started kicking up and all those adjustable rate mortgages started kicking up and people were not able to make the payments, the housing market collapsed. And like a bad game of musical chairs, all the banks that had that questionable paper, that questionable mortgages, watched it just disappear. And then again, off to the rescue, in comes the federal government to take that first encouraged the banks to make bad loans, in some cases regulated the banks to make questionable loans. The banks then took it the next step farther and said, well, let's figure out how we can make some more money off of this and give us even more exposure. And then when the music stopped, the federal government came in and said, nope, we'll make everything whole. And then surprise, surprise, the banks are doing it again. I've mentioned it to you before. SVB, I expect to be only the first in a series of banks that are going to have this problem. Because we never learned. The child that never gets punished for their bad actions never stops doing them. The child that always gets what they want becomes a spoiled brat and eventually the spoiled adult. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a generation of spoiled adults. Sadly, we have a lot more than just a generation because we have people in government that have never paid the price for their bad actions. So SVB goes down. Oh, my God, what are we going to do? Federal government to the rescue. We're going to get the American taxpayer to pay for the bad management of SVB. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. You are going to pay off what the SVB owns through what's called the Federal Deposit Insurance Company Corporation, I guess. Now, it's interesting, the federal government has no legal authority to establish this, but they created a backstop. They put you as the underwriter, right? The co-signer for the insurance on all those bank deposits. We've all seen the sign. You walk into a bank, FDIC insured, up to $250,000 is insured by the American people. They say it's insured by the FDIC, which was set up by the federal government and is funded by the American people. No, Paul, it's funded by the fees that the banks pay to be part of the FDIC. Not nearly enough, ladies and gentlemen. Not nearly enough. Well, for example, Treasury Secretary Yellen announced that they have a plan to fully protect all the depositors of SVB. Today, we are taking decisive action to protect the U.S. economy by strengthening public confidence in our banking system. I don't know about you, but this doesn't instill trust in the banking system. That the American people basically are the bank of last resort. No matter how badly you act, no matter how badly you fail, you expect the American people to pick up the tab. See, currently, the FDIC protects a depositor up to $250,000 per depositor, per person. But you see, that's not what the Yellen plan is doing. Between the FDIC and the Federal Reserve, they plan to ensure to cover all the deposits. The deposits will be beyond $250,000. Now, according to the statement, no losses associated with the SVB will be borne by the taxpayer. I don't believe them. I don't believe them. Why? How could it possibly not be borne by the taxpayer? Especially, you know, again, you have a bank that paid fees to protect depositors up to $250,000. But you just announced that you're going to protect not only the insured, but the uninsured as well. How could that cost not be borne by the federal taxpayer? SVB certainly isn't going to bear that cost, even though it was their malfeasance, their mismanagement that led to this. And the regulators said, we're going to do the same thing for Signature Bank. We're doing it all over again, ladies and gentlemen. We said, government, we want you to regulate the banks. We created a Dodd-Frank, which, you know, just destroyed local community banks. It made middle-sized banks and small banks, it made them run through all sorts of hoops. It was supposed to protect us from this ever happening again, and we're watching it happen again. And suddenly, somehow, Janet Yellen says, this is going to put confidence in our banking system. Ladies and gentlemen, it should show that our banking system is limping along on a wing and a prayer. Because when banks act badly, they aren't the ones that pay the price. Now, I don't know how much money the FDIC has on hand. I don't know how much money they take in fees every year. But based on what happened in 2008 and 2009... there's not enough money there to cover all the expenses of just, maybe they could cover these two banks, but do we think that's going to be the last bank? What happens when the third, fourth, fifth bank starts failing? Are they going to say, well, you did this for those banks, you've got to do it for us as well? Are the depositors that trusted that the federal government would be there to back them, do they truly trust that the government will? And the moral hazard that comes from saying, you don't have to worry about it, we'll protect you. Because, ladies and gentlemen, nobody at the FDIC or the Federal Reserve or anybody, any of the federal bank regulators is going to lose their job over the fact that this bank was not managed properly and the regulators either were ignorant or apathetic. They either didn't know or they didn't care. Which means the next time this comes around, guess who's going to not care? See, if we had an actual deposit insurance corporation, an independent company that actually had to make a profit, that actually had to be liquid, that could actually cover these deposits out of its own capital, well, then they would do things like make sure that the insurance premiums covered the risk, just like you do with life insurance, just like you do with car insurance. They'd look at these banks and say, do you still qualify? Are you operating in a way that changes our risk? If you are more risky, we have to charge you more. If you're less risky, well, then we can charge you less. But we don't do that. We let federal regulators, and they have to treat everybody the same, remember? Because for some reason, they don't realize you've got to look at the actual risk. Because it's not their money. No matter what they say, no matter what they do, this is not their money. Janet Yellen is not going to pay a price for having to bail out yet another, to have bail out a bank and to have the American people, directly or indirectly, footing the bill for it. And if you think last week's bank failures was the end of the line, history would suggest, it would suggest a different outcome. It would suggest that this is the beginning of the wave, not the end. And once again, the American people will be on the hook for the malfeasance of banks, for the malfeasance of regulators, and for the malfeasance of politicians. Remember, the FDIC came in because they said, "Hi," I said, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." That should scare the pants off of you. Now, there are some entities that are trying to make a change, and I want to take a look at them. But first, I have to take a break. Now, I hope you'll head to the website, constitutionstudy.com. I've got articles and videos over there. You can ask a question. I love when people ask a question. In fact, I'm going to answer a couple questions at the end of the program today. Just go to constitutionstudy.com, look for Ask a Question, hit the checkbox if you want me to answer it on the radio. I'd be more than happy to. Also, if you have a hard time falling asleep or staying asleep, my wife has had that for quite a while. Well, I suggest you check out Healthy Cells REM Sleep. It is the only sleep supplement designed to support all four stages of sleep, and it uses simple vitamins. It helps you fall asleep, stay asleep, and sleep deeply so you can wake up refreshed and ready to go. Now, as an America Out Loud listener, you can get 25% off your first order of anything from Healthy Cell by using the code Out Loud at checkout. So please, go to HealthyCell.com, check out any of their products, but use that code Out Loud at checkout. It lets them know you listen to America Out Loud, and as a thank you, you get 25% off your first order.
Do you know there's no other condition that I'm aware of where vitamins and supplements make such a big difference than COVID-19? We have an abundance of data that we need to be replete with a variety of micronutrients, and that includes vitamins, minerals, and other substances our bodies need. I rely on Healthy Cell Super Boost. That's Immune Super Boost. It's a gel pack that can be taken every day. I like to do it before I exercise and before I go out. It's a wonderful supplement. It gives me the immune super boost that I need. Go to HealthyCell.com, use the promotional code OUTLOUD, and get a discount on your first order. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
These days, every time you turn on the news, it seems like there's a new threat to your health. Maintaining a strong immune system has never been more critical. Advanced nutrition company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost to help you strengthen your immunity. Unlike other supplements that don't work, Immune Super Boost is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra absorption of science-backed nutrients proven to support immunity, like vitamin C, D3, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea. These physician-formulated gels come in a small gel pack. Tear off the top and shoot it down, or mix it in water. Boost your immunity. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. Risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD.
Hello, I'm Ben Marble, MD, and I founded MyFreeDoctor.com as a donation-supported, faith-based nonprofit with a mission to save lives by delivering free doctor visits to patients in all 50 states of America. MyFreeDoctor.com treats a broad range of health concerns like COVID-19, long COVID, sinus infections, urinary tract infections, rashes, medication refills, and more. So please visit MyFreeDoctor.com, where we're healing America one person at a time.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study, where you read and study the Constitution. Today, we're talking about, how government protection just ruin your life. I spent the first segment talking about the recent bank failures, and guess what? Well, during that break of this, when I recorded this, there are even more banks failing. It's almost like it was foreseen. Almost like we could learn from our history, except we don't. Now listen, I don't know how bad this is going to get, but I'm pretty sure it's going to get worse. Because, let's face it, if there's one thing the government has been really bad at, it's managing money. Because let's face it, none of it is theirs. They don't care about it. It doesn't matter. I think, Milton Friedman said there were four ways of spending money. When you spend money on yourself, you care about what it costs and how good it is. When you spend your money on someone else, well then, you care about the cost, but not so much the quality. When you spend someone else's money on yourself, well, you care about the quality, but not so much the cost. And when you spend someone else's money on someone else, you don't care about anything, which is pretty much the way government works. So people have watched as government, between the directly and through the Federal Reserve and monetary policy and fiscal policy, have basically trashed the American dollar. They've looked for ways to protect themselves from it. Now, one of the ways that people have tried protecting themselves is cryptocurrency. Now, cryptocurrency has its own issues. For one thing, although people say it's not a fiat currency, it's the definition of fiat currency. It's not based in anything. There's nothing behind it. They claim that, oh, well, you know, there's only a certain number of Bitcoin. Well, that's only a piece of code. I could change that in about 30 seconds with access to the source code. But it's this idea of how do we get a currency that's outside of the control of the federal government? Good question. Because the problem with cryptocurrency is sooner or later, the government's going to come in and regulate it because, well, that's kind of what they do. Now, what's interesting is some of the states have, well, they're working out ways of protecting themselves from the mismanagement from the federal government. The states of both Texas and Tennessee have bills in their legislature that would make gold and silver legal tender within the state. Now, why is this important? Well, first of all, the states can use gold and silver as legal tender. Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the Constitution says that no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque or reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, which means they can make gold and silver. They specifically are authorized to make gold and silver coins a tender of payment of debts. Meaning they can make a legal tender. Now, that's issue number one. The reason number two it's important is gold and silver retain value. I forget where I read it. It must have been about 10 or so years ago, maybe 15. A company did an analysis. They looked at the price of the average home, I think it was the 1950s, and in the early 2000s. And they compared it in two different metrics. One, in U.S. dollars. And as you would expect, right, the home of the 1950s was a fraction of the cost of that same home in 2000 dollars. Inflation, right, is what you expect, right? It gets more expensive. But what they found interesting is the median home price in gold was pretty much the same. Now, again, what does that mean? It means it's not that the house has gotten more expensive. It's that the dollars have become less valuable. The price of gold remains steady, or the value of gold, I should say, remained steady. The price of gold went up, not because the gold was more valuable, but because the dollar was less valuable. That means that these states, Texas, Tennessee, and others, they're looking at giving their citizens a new option. Rather than be dependent on the Federal Reserve, the federal government, and the Federal Reserve note that whose value is not based in anything, how about we give you the option of looking at gold? Now, several states have set up precious metal depositories, places where you can store gold and silver. Okay. Well, that's kind of step number one, isn't it? If the entire financial markets just burn down, you can go to a place they've kept your gold on deposit. Not a bad deal. Of course, could they also start doing other things that would make it more useful? Could they issue certificates that represent certain values of gold? Notes, so to say. Well, that becomes constitutionally problematic because Article 1, Section 10 says they cannot make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. So they can't really make paper money. Could they come up with another way of trading gold and silver coin? Something not akin to a debit card. Again, if it was kept strictly within the state, it gives options. And I think that's really the point. It's not that they're looking to replace the interstate monetary system, the banking system. They want to give their people a choice. Wouldn't it be nice if I could go down to town to the local branch of my state's gold depository, take my whatever checks I've received, whatever income I've received, go down to that depository and buy gold that they hold on deposit for me? Yeah, all right, buy gold. And then when I want it, I can either get it back in U.S. dollars or maybe in gold or silver coins. Reminds me of a book I read several years ago. It involved some societal upheaval. They never told you what really happened, but governments kind of collapsed and society started collapsing. And as the people came out of the initial melee, the initial problems, and they started trading again, one of the things that people found was, a lot of people that had they stocked away gold. Well, gold was kind of hard to trade. The protagonist in this story, he'd actually squirreled away silver dimes because the value of silver was more tradable. You're not going to take an ounce of gold and go buy a gallon of milk. It's going to be hard to make change. A couple silver dimes, though, may make more sense. Now, what does that mean for the American citizen, for the person living in the United States? Does it mean you shouldn't have silver or gold? Having silver or gold may make a lot of sense. I'm not a financial advisor. Do your own research, but I do think a lot of people that have silver and gold, they're not making a bad choice, especially if they have physical silver or gold. I'm a little nervous about certificates of silver and gold because what's to say the place, the depository holding that doesn't go belly up and those certificates become worthless. So I'm much more into the physical aspect. But also, if you're thinking about using it for trade in some dystopian future, take into consideration the denominations you'd be dealing with. That's my personal recommendation. So what else has the government gotten into and generally made a mess of? Who here remembers the days before ethanol gasoline? Right, where they mixed the ethanol gasoline blend. There's still stores, by the way, there's still gas stations where you can get non-ethanol gasoline. You pay a premium for it, but it's still available. Now, they kept saying, well, this is important to reduce emissions. Yeah, that didn't work too good, did it? They said, well, it's greener. Of course, they didn't appear to take into account that ethanol doesn't have the energy density of gasoline. Now, listen, again, I'm not a scientist. I haven't studied this, but you know what I've done? I've watched racing my entire life. Family, I grew up around watching things, IndyCar, the Indianapolis 500, all those races. And what's interesting is during the debate about ethanol-based gasoline, I said, hey, they even use it in race cars. Yeah, they do. But not for the fuel mileage and not for the energy potential. They use it for safety. So this whole thing, but government said, no, this is the right thing to do. E15. And of course, then what do we have? We started having, food shortages, right? Corn. Remember when those in the Southwest, couldn't get tortillas because we were literally burning our fuel in our gas tanks. Now, why did we decide to do that? Why did we decide to burn fuel, burn our food in our gas tanks? Simple. Lobbying. The places that grew a lot of corn said, hey, let's use that. If you want to put something in gas, other, you know, an alcohol, let's use corn. Is corn the most efficient product to turn into ethanol? Not as far as I understand. There's a reason why places, they said, well, you know, South American countries do it. Yeah, you know what they have a lot of? Sugar. Sugar is much more efficient at making ethanol than corn, but we don't have that much sugar here. We have corn. And now nobody should be surprised that the U.S. Senator from Iowa, where they grow a lot of corn, Joni Ernst, she wants the White House to push the country to go to year-round E15, 15% alcohol, 15% ethanol. Now, she says that year-round, permanent E15 in the Midwest would be good. Why? Maybe it's the donations she's getting from the corn growers? I don't know that. I'm not saying that's the answer. I'm saying that might. Why is she trying to push this forward? What is the benefit? Tell me, what is the benefit as a consumer of E15 fuel? Or I should say more importantly, why should it be available in the Midwest year-round? Why is it not available in the Midwest year-round now? Well, apparently gasoline producers, they're concerned that it'll hurt supply. And of course, when you restrict supply, you end up with higher prices. And people are already not happy with high gas prices. Yes, it's down from the $5 national average it was several months ago. But it's not down where it was before, and anything that would drive it back up, probably politically disadvantageous. But other than politically, isn't it disadvantageous to the American people? In other words, is this a move to satisfy the corn industry in Iowa at the expense of, well, the rest of the people in the Midwest that are going to be forced to buy more expensive fuel? Or is the gasoline producers, are they simply reluctant to change and just using this as an example? I don't know all the details. I'll tell you what I do know. I know I don't trust a politician to have my best interests in mind when she's pushing for this continued meddling in gasoline production. Now, before I go off and answer a couple of questions that were posted on the website, there's one more bill I want to talk about. I've mentioned this already. In fact, I mentioned that there's another podcaster at AmericaOutLoud.com that we kind of disagreed originally on this particular piece of Florida legislation. And we actually finally got a chance to get on the phone. And it took several days. Our schedules were crazy. But we were actually able to get on the phone and talk it over. And we both presented, this is what I read, this is what I think. One, I thought it was productive, right? Because this person brought something out that I hadn't thought of. He had a point of view that I did not originally think of. And I pointed out something that he hadn't originally noticed. And I think that is good. That's the, as I said, it's the way we should deal with disagreements and debates as gentlemen. We came to each other. We respected each other. We had a discussion and we both walked away. I wouldn't say that we were in 100% agreement, but we understood each other's position and why we had it. Now, here's the way I read this. And this is from Florida Bill SB 1316. And I have to tell you, my biggest issue with the reporting had to do with the hyperbolic titles that were used. Oh, it's a fascist legislation that it's to get bloggers to register if they talk about a candidate. Well, let's read what the legislation actually says. If a blogger posts to a blog about an elected state officer and receives or will receive compensation for that post, the blogger must register with the appropriate office as identified in paragraph 1F within 5 days after the first post by the blogger, which mentions an elected state office. I should say state officer. See, now, most people put this as, see, we're going to be registering anybody, bloggers, for political speech. It's not exactly what it says. If you're going to get paid for that post. In other words, to me, this is a campaign finance question. If, and the point this person brought up, which I thought was worth considering, was, well, let's say you have somebody, they're a monthly donor, and they send money to you every month, and you post about an elected officer, does that mean you have to register? Well, not the way I read this legislation so far, because you have to be getting compensation for that post. In other words, if you are paid to write a post or series of posts about an elected officer, you must register. Now, I still have problems with this. I'm not saying this is a perfect bill, because if the idea of if it's election finance, that the campaign finance, that's a consideration, why is it an elected officer? Why is it not a candidate? If all it is to deal with attacking elected officials, then we've got a freedom of speech issue. But it's not nearly as bad as some, we'll say, hyperbolic media have made it out to be. As I said, I have a couple questions. I always encourage people to ask questions. I have a couple that I want to answer, but I have to take a break first. Before I do, I want to let you know, I gave you an example where two of us in America Out Loud, we had different voices, different visions on the same story, which is a good thing, which is why I recommend you go to America Out Loud every day to find out what's going on. Hear multiple sides of a story, look at their evidence, look at the details they provide, and then you can decide what is true. You can judge their evidence and decide who you want to follow. And you'll probably find out that none of us are 100% true. None of us are 100% accurate, but that's part of being human. Now, what you can do is to take those stories, the contradictory ones, the ones you agree with, take the articles, take the podcasts, take the videos, share them. Share them with friends and family. Show them multiple sides of the same story and the same issue. Help us all to think about the blessings of liberty, not just I get to say what I want, I get to listen to what other people have, I want to see both parts. That is how we understand, that's how we secure the blessings of liberty.
We are fighting the ultimate fight between good and evil. AmericaOutLoud.com replaces groupthink with innovative think. Well, it was Walt Whitman, the poet, who said, "Keep your face always toward the sunshine, and shadows will fall behind you." America Out Loud Talk Radio, liberty and justice for all.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day, yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
You wouldn't go a day without brushing your teeth or washing your hands. What about washing your nose? I mean, your nose does filter the air you breathe, air loaded with bacteria, viruses, and irritants. Make nasal hygiene part of your routine with Clear. No messy bottles to fill, no drowning sensation. Clear is a natural drug-free saline with the added benefit of xylitol, which blocks bacterial and viral adhesion. Available in stores and online at clear.com. That is X-L-E-A-R.com.
Welcome back, everyday American. Thank you for joining the Constitution Study. Glad you came back. And today we've been talking about how government protections tend to ruin our lives. And this third segment, I'm going to leave two questions. We've already talked about the FDIC and the bank failures and how we're doing the same thing we did in 2007 and 2008. We really shouldn't expect any sort of different outcome. We then talked about how states like Texas and Tennessee are trying to protect themselves from the bad monetary and fiscal policies of our government and the limitations on that. But now it's question time. And I got a couple of really good questions. The first one comes from a gentleman nicknamed Lefty. Now, I had the pleasure of actually doing a point-counterpoint interview with Lefty on another program, a podcast here at America Out Loud. So you can find it was Greg Bolden's program, Bolden America. And we had an interesting discussion. Now he sent me this very interesting question. He sent me a link to a report about a court case, and he wanted my opinion about whether or not this was constitutional. This comes out of the article, I think, was from the Washington Post, but it involves a woman out of the state of Washington. Recently, a Tacoma woman had a warrant issued for her arrest because she refuses to get treated for tuberculosis. That's kind of the general sentiment. Now, I'm looking only at the article. The article he sent me was a Washington Post. I don't have a subscription, so I actually found another article about to give me some background. Now, as I understand it, back in January of 2022, she was diagnosed with tuberculosis, and a Pierce County Superior Court basically issued an order that she comply with testing and treatment. Now, the judge, a Philip Sorensen, he didn't agree with her objection. She has objections to being treated, and the court said, "Nah, we don't get along with that." Now, what's interesting is there have been 17 different hearings and multiple court orders and others. Basically, the woman refuses to get treatment. So from my point of view, from a constitutional point of view, here's the way I'm looking at it. Does the woman have a right to refuse treatment? Yes, it is her body. As long as it only impacts her body, then she has a right to refuse treatment. The problem is, the court said, either you get treatment or you quarantine. And that, to me, is where life gets very interesting. Now, there's a case out of Boston, I think it was in the late 1800s, no, early 1900s, of a gentleman who got off of a ship. He got off of a ship in the harbor that had, he had been exposed to smallpox. And he was told, either you take the vaccine, you quarantine, and you pay a $5 fine. If my memory of the case, I can't think of the name of the case off the top of my head. I'm sure somebody will mention it somewhere along the line. So here's the question I have to ask. Has this lady gone through due process to show that she is a danger to others? Well, according to an article I found at the Mayo Clinic, latent TB or TB where the infection is inactive is not contagious, whereas active TB, which is where you actually get sick, that is contagious. But again, according to the Mayo Clinic, it is not easy to catch. You're more likely to get it from someone you live with or work with rather than a stranger. So most people with active TB who've had appropriate drug treatment for at least 2 weeks are no longer contagious. So the question first is her TB active or not? Therefore, is she contagious or not? And that becomes the crux of the constitutional matter. Right? She has liberty, but she cannot use that liberty to harm others. If she is contagious, if there is evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that she is contagious and therefore can spread this, then yes, there's a, if the if due process has been followed, in other words, her rights have been protected. They've got evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that she is a danger to others because she is contagious. She can spread this disease. Then the court has justification for ordering her to do something about it. What are the limits? And again, I don't have access to the actual court order. I don't know exactly what she's been ordered to do. So there's, I have to hedge a little bit in this and deal with generalities rather than the specifics. Just as with the smallpox case in Massachusetts, there is evidence, if there is evidence that she is contagious, then she can be ordered to either take treatment or quarantine. Now, that's where the other part of this story comes in when I think about this, when I'm looking at this in generalities. Is she being ordered to isolate, to quarantine, or is she being ordered to take treatment? Now, according to a statement that was posted to an online blog by the Tacoma Pierce County Health Department, the woman is still refusing to isolate and get the treatment she needs to treat her tuberculosis. There I have a problem. Okay, you want to isolate her so that she's not a danger to others. I understand that. But you're telling me that she needs to take treatment because you say she needs it. That's still her body. She has every right to refuse treatment. If it means that in order to be, she has to be isolated to save others, that's her choice. And that to me is where the court may be going too far. They can require isolation. They cannot require treatment because now the court is violating her rights, not for the benefit of others, but for the benefit of her. And to do that, they have to show that she is somehow incompetent of making this decision, which I don't know. Maybe they have, and it's not in the report here. Again, I don't have all the transcripts of what's going on. But again, it brings to my mind an interesting thought experiment. The idea of we think about these things before we encounter them is the best way to deal with them. My first impression is, has there been probable cause? Has there been due process? Is she been shown to be a danger to society? Then you deal with the danger to society, but you don't deal with the danger to her. See, that's where the health department and the judge's order gives me pause. You want to isolate her because she's a danger to others. That can be justified constitutionally. You want to order her to get treatment. That cannot. So Lefty, thank you for, again, an interesting, Lefty doesn't ask me easy questions. He lets me know I've got to have I got to have some time to think about these. So that's that one. The other question I have is from a longtime listener who goes by the handle Tunnel Lord. He asked the question, and again, he sent a lot of topics. He asked me to talk about, are the states subservient to the federal government? Now, those of you who listen regularly may remember yesterday's episode where I talked about Tennessee's nullification law that is currently in the legislation that would establish a framework for Tennessee to nullify within its borders unconstitutional federal acts. I also interviewed the member of the House that sponsored the House bill, and the understanding is no, states are not subservient to the federal government. Now, it should not be a surprise that, well, several people have come back with rather overexcited and hyperbolic reactions. Are you telling me the states don't have to listen to the federal government? No. The best way I can explain this is the states, as the creators of the federal government, are generally, yes, they are superior to the federal government. They have, however, delegated to the federal government some of their powers. Those powers now belong to the federal government. They are not superior in those specific areas. But since the states are the only entities legally allowed to modify the Constitution, thereby modifying the powers delegated to the United States, the powers which the federal government can exercise, they could change those rules. If the states decide that the federal government isn't doing a good job at something, they can go in and change it through a constitutional amendment. Now, the reason I believe Tunnel Lord wanted me to talk about this, it's a topic that comes up quite frequently. It's recognizing that the states are not bound to absolutely everything the federal government does, because the states, as the parties to the compact that created the federal government, that created the three branches and delegated them their powers, the federal government can then tell the people who created them, we're assuming new powers you didn't give us, and you must bend the knee. Of course, the other part to remember is that the people created the states. And when they created the states, they did so with their own constitution, where they delegated to the state there's a limited number of powers, certain specific powers. And therefore, the people are also sovereign over the states, as well through the states over the federal government. Now, this is not to be confused with the sovereign citizen movement, but it's to recognize what most states already recognize in their constitution, that all power is inherent in the people, that they delegate that power to government to act in their name, first at the state level, actually generally first at the city and county level, but at the state level, and then from the state level to the federal level. Now, this is one of the founding principles of the Constitution Study Program. I'm working on this program start out with a mini boot camp where I'm going to explain this in greater detail. It's part of a larger project I'm working on. I'll be talking about it as I develop it. But the idea of understanding the limited powers of the federal government, that to me is important. Because it's only through the proper understanding of the powers, the separation of powers, the defense of powers, not only between the branches of government, but between the various governments of this country, it's fundamental to understanding the republics that our framers gave us, that our founding fathers gave us, that they fought for and bled for and many died for. So, Tunnel Lord, I thank you for your question, not simply because it was a good question, but because it kind of brings me back to the beginning. And this idea of having the government protect us. See, if you go to the Declaration of Independence, governments are there to protect our rights, not to protect us. And when we let governments get beyond their designed boundaries, well, then things go south. Sure, it's easy to say the government will come in and protect us from natural disasters or from bank failures or from bad food or bad drugs. But the more we put power in others, the less power we have for ourselves. And if we give them powers they don't legally have, where are the boundaries set? I mean, think about it. In the 1930s, the federal government suddenly decided it needed to protect people who hadn't saved for their retirement. Granted, at the time, people didn't retire. Not really. They basically, when they were unable to work, they were dependent on others in their family. But the government came in and says, no, we have a way you should do this, and you have to do this our way. And that government protection became government dependency. And the government dependency has ruined many a life. I remember having the debate with my grandfather at one point. And I told him, I said, listen, if the government stopped collecting Social Security tax from me, I would take that money and split it equally amongst all my family members above age 65. I guarantee you'll get a better response to that than you would from the federal government. I invested my own money towards my retirement, and I've gotten a much better return on that than anything the government has claimed to give. See, we forget that government protection comes with government strings. In order to protect you, you must follow our rules. He who pays the piper calls the tune. Government protection is not merely government protection. It's government enslavement. And while it may be started for the best of reasons, the best of intentions, I can't really think of a government program that hasn't ended up ruining people's lives. Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, Obamacare, the FDIC, the government loan programs, the student loan programs, this whole process eventually ruins people's lives. Because once they're outside of any control, of any accountability, there's nothing to keep them doing what is best for the people they claim to serve. Now, I'm sure there are plenty of people out there that disagree with me. That's okay. I don't have a problem with that. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if you disagree with me. When this program comes out on the podcast, go to the show page and leave a comment. Or go to the website, constitutionstudy.com. Leave a comment, ask a question. But I hope you'll come back here. I hope you let people know that every weekday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, they can hear the Constitution Study on America Out Loud Talk Radio, heard on the iHeartRadio Network. If you can't listen then, these shows go to podcast a day or two after they're heard on talk radio. And you can find them on your favorite podcast app. But do me a favor, subscribe to the program. Give me a rating, a review. It helps others find the Constitution Study as well. You can find all the links at the homepage at AmericaOutLoud.com. But I'm going to ask you a favor. You see, if you want to be part of the solution and not just part of the problem, I want you to share those links. Share the links, share the articles, the videos, you name it. Share it as far as you can. Because by sharing that, you're also sharing the blessings of liberty.